All right, you happily miserable accursed. Lots to talk about today, so let's get the pod started. Hurley here with the political panel, Leichnitz tonight, and Reed. Last week we said we would talk about the provincial elections in Saskatchewan and New Brunswick. This week we'll actually do it. Then it's Trudeau versus the premiers. Almost all the first ministers are pushing for a meeting on the carbon tax and pushing back on the spending announcements. We'll talk about that. Our cursed clipping is from Mark McQueen writing in the Star about pugnacious Pierre Poilievre and how he really doesn't care what elites think about his combative attitude. Then to end the pod, as we always do, the great Mr. Pinsent and our Hey Yous. But to start the show today, I want to do a little reminiscing about someone who really just inspired the hell out of me. A political star, a federal cabinet minister, and then Liberal Party president who helped remake the party for the better back in her day, and who then went on to become Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia. You know, she was, Jordan, in an era where it made her a lot of firsts. She was one of the first cabinet female cabinet ministers. She was the first female president of the Liberal Party, and she was the first female Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia. You know, I don't know, one of the things about this show is that time marches on and people who were important in the past get sort of forgotten. And I don't think she should be forgotten. Scotty, you knew her, right?
I did, yeah. I think you may have been the first person to introduce me to her, as a matter of fact. So she chaired Paul's campaign in 1990. She chaired Paul's campaign in... did she chair Paul's campaign in 2002? No. I don't think she did she?
No, she was already Lieutenant Governor.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, I'll leave it to you. You knew her better than I did. But I hinted at this story on Twitter. But I remember, what was the name of the nightclub? You remember that nightclub in Montreal where we had that giant party, David? Metropolitan, was it?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I don't even know if it still exists.
That was a good party.
Yeah. It's been weeks since I spent time at Montreal nightclub. So
Corey was just there.
Like, I can give you a report
at 7 a.m. But we're having this big party, and this to me is the essence of Iona and her presence and poise. So we're having this party. It's mostly like a youth party. We've gathered kids from all across Canada. It's at this nightclub. Loud, sweaty, disjointed place in Montreal. The national media are there. There's this crazy little woman, middle-aged woman who's there, and she chases Paul basically from event to event to event. So she's there through the corner of my eye. Every time Paul goes out to mingle for the purposes of the media on the dance floor or something, I have to snag this woman, steer her away from Paul, and then she gets onto Iona. And everyone is frustrated by this one, but Iona just stands there. There's heat, there's sweat, there's smashing of bodies, and this little creature is on her ass, tugging at her elegant robes and trying to get her attention. And Iona is just chill. There's literally a cloud of cool air around her. She is just poised and elegant, and there's just something really commanding about her. And people talked about how remarkable her appearance was and stuff, but that doesn't capture it, because it isn't just that she was a striking looking person. It was that she commanded the space around her. She was indisputably authoritative in any interaction that she took part in. And it was just, always in awe of her. I was literally, I guess that would be the word I would say, I was in awe of her.
Corey, I'm just going to give you one example. In 1983, she did a tour of Saskatchewan and I advanced it. And the thing I'll never forget, because 1983 was, you know, up until now, the nadir of Liberal politics in Saskatchewan. It was the end of Pierre Trudeau's reign. It was the National Energy Program. It was everything. And we were just dead, flat on our ass. She came out and did this tour, and I remember 350 people at 8 o'clock in the morning at a breakfast in Prince Albert. And I was like, holy fuck, this person is a true star, because there's no way any organization could have got that number of people out for any other Liberal. Anyway, and bottom line is, I was on the national executive of the party with her. I was a young liberal representative. We used to spar frequently, and I believe her to have been the first person to coin the phrase the hurly-burly to refer to me. So,
oh, now that's a piece of sugar.
Right there. There you go.
Yeah. All right. There you go. All right, let's move on. Provincial elections. We got two to talk about, Saskatchewan and New Brunswick. Jordan, let's start in Saskatchewan, and let's start with you. There was Saskatchewan party's been in power for 17 years, consecutive majority governments throughout that period of time. Sometimes the NDP leader doesn't win their seat. Last time they did, but sometimes they don't. Ever since Calvert left, this has been a beating of a province. And what we're seeing on the street is a lot of conflict in Saskatchewan. There's been a long teacher strike, or a long teacher's action, that is culminating in, I think, full work stoppage this week. But in any event, it's been a big deal for a long time. I thought the teachers had the wind in their sails. There was one poll that showed the NDP very close. Still wouldn't win the election because of the rural-urban splits, but one poll showed them very close. Then another poll came out and said, no, it's actually not close. And Angus Reid continues to find Scott Moe over 50% in favorability. Other than a dip down to 40 during COVID, he's not been below 50 for two terms in approval. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we can put a fork in this, can't we, unfortunately?
Well, I don't know about that. That seems awfully pessimistic of you. I don't think you can put a fork in this yet. And I think that it's really interesting what's happening in Saskatchewan, because my sense, in the sense, I think, of, you know, and of course you and Corey would follow this really closely, but I think what has changed also in the last few months is that the Saskatchewan Party and Mo, they've lost the media, for one thing, I think, in a way that we really haven't seen before. You have a situation where he is hemorrhaging caucus members, including, by the way, cabinet members and his finance minister, who is supposed to be out defending this budget that he just tabled, that I don't think, it's pretty long on promises, but not enough money to deliver for things. And folks have seen this movie before in 2016. You make a lot of big budget commitments, and then they all suddenly vanish after the election. So I think that there's a high level of cynicism, certainly, about Mo and his commitments at this point. And I think his team thinks that there's a problem. Otherwise, they wouldn't be out trying to soften his image, with the new ad and the motto around classroom care and communities. I don't know if you guys saw that. I don't really think people are buying it. I actually thought there was an article, and gosh, it would be maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago now, a Murray Mandrick piece that really was pretty telling. This is the one about Mo being booed at the Briar finals. And I think his point there, which I think is an illustrative one, maybe beyond snapshot polls in the moment, of which there's not really enough to get, I think, a complete picture of what's happening, is that if you've lost that room in Regina, the folks who are attending that event, that is not a good sign. There is a feeling that there's a fatigue with this government. There's an unhappiness around core issues like education, which is why the teachers have had some wind in their sails on this conflict. And I think that, to me, says that there's still quite a lot of possibility there for the NDP. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, and I know Corey's going to come back and talk about
the carbon tax. I think you're hanging around Regina Lakeview and not Maple Creek.
No. Well, maybe. But the other thing I'll say is that there is, you know, obviously all governments, when they are defeated, defeat themselves. And I think that if it does come to pass for Mo, this will be no exception, because the carbon tax against the NDP in Saskatchewan, I think, is not nearly as effective a wedge. There's very little daylight between the Saskatchewan Party and the Saskatchewan NDP on that topic. And Mo, in terms of his globetrotting to COP, he didn't help himself there on that. So he's really squandered some of his own potential advantage on that topic and made it, I think, much less salient in the campaign. So Yeah, I don't think it's done by any means. I think that there's quite a lot of space for the NDP to grow, to seize on some of this discontent and grow it. They do have an uphill battle in terms of the vote splits in the ridings that they need to win, but I would absolutely not say that it's impossible. I think that they're doing a lot of things right.
A question for you loyal Hurlyburlyites who tune in here every week. Did you ever think you'd absorb so many data points about CRTC hearings? Or the best way to wholesale wireline fiber to the premises. So there's real sustainable competition out there between the companies who want to provide it to you. Yeah, I mean, neither. But given the ubiquity of the internet, high speed internet, all the critical stuff it does for us, and the price we pay for it, the whole topic is pretty germane, eh? Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, thinks so. TELUS started life as a regional copper telephone company. A few decades later, hard to argue they've been the most successful new entrant in the telecom industry. With a history of investing in the communities they serve, making bold, i.e. really big, investments to innovate their products and services and venture into new markets. Mobility, business solutions, home internet, security and home automation, TV, content and entertainment solutions, healthcare and agricultural solutions, TELUS accomplished all of this under the existing regulatory framework, expanding nationally west from BC to connect us. Short story is, they've got the bona fides to provide sustainable, innovative, and differentiated competition for more Canadians. That means more Eastern Canadians, Hurlyburlyites. TELUS wants to expand eastward. They also believe in the virtue of investing in the communities they serve, which is why you heard them recommend a disaggregated mandate last week. Remember? Skin in the game. Building more connection points for home internet, increasing its reliability and security right across the country, and innovating new services with their keen focus on customer experience, new plans and bundles, new features and technologies, all of which pushes their competition in Ontario, Quebec, and everywhere else to improve their own offerings. Customers win either way. A specific example of one of those innovative products next week. Corey, you know, I think that Jordan has actually fairly accurately described the situation of Regina and Saskatoon. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is fatigue with the government of Regina and Saskatoon. And I think those cities are showing some signs of not being fully attended to. But nonetheless, the math of the Saskatchewan legislature is relentless. And you can't win the government there without winning seats. Regina and Saskatoon doesn't get you there.
Right. Right?
You got to win. If the NDP are not going to win rural Saskatchewan, they have to win everything that Saskatchewan considers urban. Right? Right? Like communities of 20,000 people, you got to win those because that's an urban riding in Saskatchewan. And so it's just... It appears until the NDP figure out a way to win some rural ridings that this is like an electoral college lock.
Yeah, that's really just the mechanics of riding distribution and seat distribution in the legislature. So, and this isn't a new dynamic for Saskatchewan politics. If you go back to the early days of the Saskatchewan Party under Ellen Hermanson. Like, they were not winning those campaigns, you know, although narrowly not winning them under Calvert because they were losing in some of those areas that, you know, Saskatchewan would consider urban and most of the rest of the world wouldn't. But, you know, you got to do well in the Lloydminster. So you got to do, you know, you got to do Sweep and Moose Jaw. You got to do well in Yorkton and Prince Albert and all of those sorts of communities. I think even Meadow Lake is considered a city now.
Yeah,
by about four people, I think.
5,004.
Yeah, but it's that's really just the raw mechanics of the thing, and with respect to those seats, I think they're safely in the Saskatchewan Party column. The teacher strike will be interesting. Like we've talked about this before, I think more offline than on the pod, but. You know, teacher strikes prove problematic for every government, no matter its complexion, and there's a dynamic there that is challenging for all governments. It's not a shock that the teachers union and the Saskatchewan Party don't see eye to eye You know, we'll see how that plays out, but it's obviously a point of aggravation for parents when kids aren't in school, especially post pandemic because of, you know, school closures, et cetera. Although I think Saskatchewan less afflicted by that than places like Ontario. I don't see any major change, and the fight with the federal government is very much helpful to Mo. You know, it's wishful thinking, I think, on the part of you, Jordan, on, you know, how the NDP is viewed around these sorts of issues in the province and elsewhere. And certainly Jagmeet Singh has done no favors to the Saskatchewan NDP by propping up the Trudeau government day in and day out, which for sure garners more news with NDP next to it than anything that the Saskatchewan NDP is doing. So, you know, barring some unforeseen disruption in their campaign narrative, I think this is going to be a pretty smooth sail to victory for Mo.
You know, Scott, tell me what you think about Scott Mo as a political performer, because, you know, it doesn't blow me away, I'll tell you that, but these are impressive approval numbers, and it's, you know, if you dug down on policy, you'd find lots of unhappiness about policy, right? I don't think people in Saskatchewan are any happier about their healthcare system than people anywhere else in Canada are. There's a lot of turmoil in the education system right now, right? Saskatchewan's facing affordability challenges, same as everybody else is, etc., right? But the guy's at 53% or something.
I think a couple of, first of all, let's be honest, okay? The two dudes other than me on the panel are from Saskatchewan. Jordan is a dyed-in-the-wool New Democrat, so Saskatchewan is a place that, you know...
And former Moose Jaw resident, by the way.
There we go. So, you know, so, like, what I know about Saskatchewan politics wouldn't fit in a can of shit. So, like, that's just the truth. But on the Mo thing, I think two things, and I can't back up any of these. These are impressions. So, just from watching... From you know, the coffee patio here in downtown Toronto. One, I think there is a steady and predictableness to him that has been very comfortable, and so I think that in part reinforces. You know what he's going to say if you're in Saskatchewan or you're outside of it before. You hear the giant creak of his large lumbering jaws open. And I think that that has generally served him well. I think that he has gotten every ounce of juice out of standing up for the interests, and particularly the energy interests of Saskatchewan, and gradually building on what Brad Wall did of creating a notion of Saskatchewan as part of Canada's energy heart, not just Alberta. I think that that's because I think there's been a gradual alteration in the identity of Saskatchewan around energy and energy politics over the course of the past 15 years or so with the Saskatchewan Party, and Mo has reinforced all that and gotten a lot of benefit out of that. And that, of course, then also reinforces the conflict with Ottawa and puts him in a strong position. But, and this is the part that I can't defend. So those are my two impressions of him and what I think explains his consistently, even within the context of the politics, Saskatchewan's consistently high standings. I think some of that stuff can boomerang on you as a political entity, right? He's in there, like that same steadiness and reliability. Politicians who are able to capture that lightning in a bottle find that sometimes it just turns on you also. I don't think that's going to happen in the election. I don't think he's vulnerable in this election. But I do get a sense that if I was him, I would get this election out of the way. I would put in maybe another year and I would get out of Dodge. 6, 7, 8 years. I don't think he wants to hang around a lot longer. I don't think that people think he's nimble and agile. I don't think they think he's responsive. I think he's steady and predictable. And, you know, I believe that all incumbents, whether that it shows up in the polls or not, are taking on water from COVID, post-COVID, cost of living. I just think that is starting to weigh people down. So I wouldn't want to spend a lot of money betting on Scott Mo being a super popular politician 3.5 years from now. I don't think that that's going to be the case. And if I was him, I'd, I get this election out of the way, bank it and book it.
Jordan, I just want to end with you. And I want to sort of link it to something, which is the members last week that announced they're not running again federally. All of them from ruralish ridings, right? All of them in trouble in the next election from the CPC. Might have won, but they were going to be in for tough fights. And then you look at the Saskatchewan math that we've just been talking about. Is there a sort of a process within the NDP or a group of people within the NDP that are giving serious thought to how to connect social democracy with rural people again?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge question, a question that social democrats in Canada are not the only ones struggling with. This is a global phenomenon. And yeah, there are a lot of people thinking about that, not just within the NDP, but also within the labor movement, to understand how to make that connection with workers all across the country. And look, I don't think there's a special sauce on it. It's the result of a whole variety of factors. But I do think that the question of connection with, at least for the Saskatchewan NDP, with rural voters, I don't think it's as far away as this conversation has made it seem. Rural voters in Saskatchewan, within recent living memory, voted NDP, and they can do it again. And I think that any campaign strategy that relies on
well, within my fucking memory, they voted Liberal. So
sure, but all things are possible. And the other thing is that when you get into a situation where, just as an example, if the NDP is able to run the table in Regina, if the Saskatchewan Party has lost the media, like, it, you can actually get into a place where the orthodoxy starts to be questioned, where there can be impacts in rural ridings, where schools are being closed down, where the affordability crisis is being felt, where hikes in utility rates are being felt. Like, there is a vulnerability there. And, the Saskatchewan NDP, they've chosen a leader who has a rural background and is comfortable in those communities. So I think that I would be careful before writing off that possibility. I think that there's still openings there. And yeah, there is absolutely still, I think, there's still strong roots. You know, it depends on what part of the country you're talking about, right? To be very clear, the picture in Saskatchewan is different than it is in Ontario, which is different than it is in BC. But the party does retain very strong roots, you know, to speak to what you're really talking about, which I think is Charlie's retirement, right? Charlie Angus's retirement. His seat, though it's becoming much larger in the redistribution, actually by losing Timmins in it, it actually becomes more winnable for the NDP. But it's massive, right? It's a huge, huge seat. And there's no question that it's a blue and orange fight, as it has been for many, many years now. And it's a very competitive fight. So I don't buy the idea that there's suddenly been some switch flipped where there's now a deep disconnect where there wasn't before. It has always been the case that the NDP does well in these ridings, mostly on the back of like very strong local representation from people like Charlie Angus, who really just pound the pavement and do the work in those rural communities to represent them. And I think His example actually really speaks to it. Like, he's leaving after 20 years, you know, with a better record of accomplishments than many people in government can claim. And that's how he got reelected. And I do think that the caucus like benefits from the diversity of those opinions. And so, you know, having those longstanding MPs retire is a loss for sure. But to me, it doesn't immediately say that there's no connection. I think that people are looking and thinking about how to refresh that, and the missing piece is how to connect it with the leadership of the party right now. That's what's not happening.
Productivity is a topic nowadays. So let's look back at a pair of ferocious Canadian entrepreneurs who left a colossal legacy. In 1899, William Mackenzie and Donald Mann founded Canadian Northern Railway in Manitoba. They started with 100 miles of track between Lake Winnipeg and Thunder Bay, then known as Port Arthur and Fort William. They then proceeded to build and acquire relentlessly. By 1902, they had 2,500 miles of track from Rainy River in Ontario through Winnipeg and onward to Erwood in the then Northwest Territories. They called their method the pioneering system, which was a euphemism for building fast to minimum standards, keeping costs down, and pushing ahead. In 1903, the pair got into a storied race for the West Coast with a competitor. They made it to Edmonton 2 years later. By that time, they'd covered roughly half the country in 6 years. But building a railroad over the Rockies is something else. Slower and a lot more expensive. Mackenzie and Mann persevered, even though their competitor, Canadian Pacific, had the easier real estate on the eastern side of the Thompson and Fraser Rivers. Both railways made it to the coast, but by the time the last spike was driven in 1916, Mackenzie and Mann were groaning under debt, and Ottawa stepped in to take over Canadian Northern. The two men were knighted for their achievements, 100 miles to 10,000 miles of track spanning seven provinces built in 18 years. Talk about productivity. Much of that line remains as sections of our sponsors network, CN. But as much as Mackenzie and Mann were titans, they were men of their time. This is now. And now, safety is the prime directive at CN. Building past standards and pushing standards is the new deal. Oh, and I should mention, CN knows a thing or two about productivity too.
You know, this whole thing, if you put it into a larger context, scares the living bejesus out of me, right? So you see the NDP becoming less suburban, less rural.
Leftism is becoming an urban phenomenon.
It is.
Yes. So I'm just saying, you look for the NDP, you see that is happening. They're becoming less labor. It's more urban identity-driven sort of definition of the party. And at the very same time, parallel to that, probably if it's a thumping in the next federal election, you're going to see a more animated discussion around merging the NDP and the Liberal parties than you've ever seen. So at a time when the NDP are becoming less connected to middle-class, lunch-bucket, labor-driven politics, like, you know, you're going to end up in this discussion about whether or not the Liberals and the NDP should be merging together. Like, I just don't like the part of the spectrum that we appear to be marching toward purchasing, you know? Like, I want a better fucking bargain.
I mean, it's been right. Your corner of the spectrum for a while, so.
Well, all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, a sunrise and a sunset kind of look the same, you know, but they're not the same. And that's all I'm going to close on.
And use your special glasses. All right. So New Brunswick. New Brunswick is more complicated, I think. The government is at the end of its second term in office. Third term now. Corey, help me.
It's longer in the tooth for sure.
Longer. Exam questions, David. This is the curse of politics, not the curse of political history. Don't reveal our ignorance.
Anyway, there's so many sharp divergences in New Brunswick politics between the North and the South, between the French and the English, between St. John's and the other parts of the province, that it gets very complicated. But the bottom line is, here is Blaine Hague's situation. He's very unpopular personally, unlike Mo, very unpopular personally. His party, unlike Mo, is in chaos as he continues to lose senior members of his government, either ministers or backbenchers who are, whether it's the issue about pronouns and his regulations about the use of pronouns in schools, or whether it's the way he did that and his management of his party and caucus, in any event, he's basically holding on to power by force majeure there. On the other hand, the consensus at 338 shows him up by 5 points. Okay? Almost certain to win. And what I know, when the Conservatives are up by 5 points, is that Brian Gallant beat Higgs by 7 points in the election he lost. But the Liberals pile up so many votes among the Francophone ridings up north that it distorts the results. And so Higgs looks still in a position to possibly win, but you can also see a situation where the campaign could go very, very badly for him. Corey, what's your take on what's going on out there? I know that Steve Outhouse, the guy that rescued Danielle Smith, has now been sent out to do the same for Higgs. So,
yeah, well, I'm a big Steve Outhouse fan, and I think campaigns, especially in tight races, really do matter, and proper campaign management does matter. And I think having Steve there is going to be very helpful to them. He's an experienced set of hands and understands how to wedge properly in order to squeak out victories in close seats. My read is that there's, you know, some good things in their corner. You know, one is I think there's a bit of a ballot pull towards Polyev, who is doing very, very well in the region overall. But he's going to be helping them, you know, in parts of the province that are sort of a little more swing. So, you know, if you're thinking sort of the Madawaska-Edmondson area or around Moncton, those are areas where I think they're doing a bit better than they have been in the past. And that's in part thanks to the popularity of Polyev. But I think there are a couple other things going on. Like Susan Holt, I don't think is a particularly well-known candidate in terms of the general population. And, you know, to go back to what we were just talking about, urban issues versus rural and more populist issues, you know, if you're going to campaign on renaming the St. John River to something with more of an Aboriginal tone, like those are the kinds of things that I could see Steve Outhouse taking and putting a gigantic spotlight on, because like they're I think out of touch with where public sentiment is, and they show a misprioritization of issues, you know, towards the woke and away from the practical.
But they really get people worked up at the Moncton Public Library, though.
Well, I would imagine, but you know, even in downtown Toronto, you want to rename Dundas Street, and you don't exactly have people cheering in the streets for it. It's sort of a weird thing to be putting in the window, but you know, campaigns are about choices, and I think it's a bad choice for the Liberals to sidle up to those kinds of fringe issues.
Jordan, what do you think?
Well, I mean, with a similar caveat to Scott's about my in-depth knowledge of New Brunswick politics, what I would say is that I think what's really interesting is that if you look at what has put Higgs on the defensive, these are issues that are really self-inflicted, right? So from the pronoun stuff and the school policy to his own style of managing caucus, these are absolutely his own goals, which is why I think since it seems like Steve Outhouse's specialty is putting problematic leaders in a box for the duration of a campaign, he's probably just the man for the job out there. Because it seems that Higgs is his own worst enemy on this stuff. I think that there's a couple things going on. So obviously there's a lot of discontent around his leadership, but also on concrete issues like healthcare. Like we're really seeing people feeling like that system is definitively broken in New Brunswick, and that's piling on top of like everywhere else in the country is piling on top of the cost of living issues. So I think that there is a vulnerability for them that the Liberals could take advantage of. I don't see a lot of, you know, in the polls, I don't see a lot of enthusiasm for any leader in New Brunswick right now. So I'm not sure that Holt's relative unknown status is necessarily a huge hindrance, because I don't think people in New Brunswick are feeling terribly keen on anybody at the moment. So whether or not she can pull together the vote coalition is another question. But I think that it's rare to see voters reward a party that is deeply engaged in introspection and internal fighting. And you also are seeing a situation here where he's losing a lot of members of cabinet. They're embroiled in terms of conflict within their own party around potential leadership reviews and things like that. None of that stuff is good news. None of that stuff is helpful. It's all distraction. So if they aren't going to an early vote, which it seems like now they are likely not, the spring window is pretty much passed. So if they're looking towards the fall, you know, maybe a nice big box can be constructed by Steve Outhouse and Higgs can be ceremoniously deposited into it. And voters can have a little bit of time without his own goals to reflect on their choices. But I don't think it's a done deal.
Today's podcast sponsor, Bruce Power, knows a thing or two about big projects. The company is undergoing a multi-year, multi-billion dollar refurbishment program, which is Canada's largest private sector infrastructure project, and will secure a reliable supply of carbon-free nuclear power for Ontario to at least 2064. Bruce Power is refurbishing 6 of its 8 generating units through its major component replacement project, which involves replacing all of the reactor internal parts, pipework, and large reactor components. Think replacing 320,000-pound steam generators using one of the world's largest cranes. Unit 6 was the first to undergo refurbishment, which began in January 2020 and was declared commercially operational last September, 39 years to the day of its first in-service date in 1984. What was not by chance was the fact that the project was completed successfully and with an industry-best safety rating for large projects. And thanks to the efforts of its employees, industry partners, and thousands of skilled tradespeople, the refurbishment was completed ahead of schedule and on budget. Unit 6 alone provides enough clean electricity to power more than 900,000 homes, and each renewed unit will be operational for more than 40 years, a period in which the independent electricity system operator forecasts the need for clean energy to more than double. Big projects also mean jobs, a lot of them. Bruce Power secures an estimated 22,000 jobs directly and indirectly from operations, and an additional 5,000 jobs annually throughout its investment program. And with over 90% of the company's spend staying within Canada, supporting hundreds of businesses, this Made in Canada project helps power the economy. You know, Scott, this guy is quite, I really don't like him. I'll be honest. I really don't like him. I don't like his style of politics. I don't like what I know about his past with the Confederation of Regions Party and all that. Just don't like his style. But the guy has quietly become, I think, the most electorally successful premier in New Brunswick since Frank McKenna. Like, they had gone through, after McKenna, a series of sort of one-term or one-and-a-half-term governments, and he has solidified things there a bit.
It does seem that way. I do think he's vulnerable. I think that there's an opening for him, but I think I'll just kind of echo a little bit of what I've heard and add one thought, which I'm not deeply informed about, but it seems to me he's personally vulnerable. I think that unless you're for him, you have substantial doubts about him, and I think that that could be leveraged in this electoral cycle in a way that could run away on him if you can be successful. I am worried about drag on the Liberal brand. I think in Ontario and the Atlantic, the brand does pick up some shadow and echo federally, and sometimes that helps and sometimes that hurts. It feels like it's going to hurt. I think that the Liberals provincially, Susan Holt, I think they've got to be better. I think they've got to really try to shift the focus onto healthcare and hammer away on healthcare and leverage soak up every ounce of negativity, sense of disorder, sense of division and chaos around this guy. You know, this guy creates problems even among his own people. Like, you soak up all of that and then go, and the reason you should give a fuck is because that means that your healthcare isn't getting better. It means that you're not getting a doctor, means you're not getting into the emergency ward. And I would just hammer on that and own that and try to take that. And then I think the last piece of it is they've got, like, the Greens are polling out there still. They have a percentage of vote. And the last 2 weeks
they have a leader with credibility.
So the last 2 weeks of an election campaign, you have to do the squeeze play and take those votes. You're the last bridge. You can lead us off of Higgs Island. Come on, Green voters. Or you have to do something before the campaign where you reach out to that credible leader and they decide they're going to work together and figure something out. But it feels to me like that's a piece of that particular New Brunswick puzzle. So there's a bigger job jar for the non-Higgs side of the equation than there is for the Higgs side of the equation. But but I think he could be vulnerable, and I'd love to see him go down because, like you, I think he's proving to be electorally effective, and I think he's a real shit, and I think he runs a shit government that stands for shit things. I don't like
gross politics. Agreed, but I did want to revisit like our conversation in New Brunswick because I think you know we talked a lot about potential strategies for handling Higgs's anti-trans policies, and I'm more persuaded than ever that now the way for the Liberals to go about it is to go straight at healthcare and to say that Higgs's obsession with this issue is hurting kids and it's because he doesn't want to talk to you about this issue that he's actually responsible for.
Corey, New Brunswick is one of the most socially conservative provinces in the country, and so I don't think the way the trans issue plays there is analogous to a lot of other places. But the one point
no abortions in New Brunswick the whole time that Frank McKenna was the premier.
Yeah, no, that's like it's just that stuff lands differently there. But the one other point I wanted to make is I think their fundraising is going to be a big advantage. Like they're doing much better in that respect, which means what does that mean? It means you can run more ads. And when you're dealing with less known candidates that you're running against, even if you're unpopular, if you can get out ahead of Susan Holt and brand her while she's an unknown, I think that's a huge advantage. And we've seen that time and time again in other races. So that's sort of the final point I'll make before we move
on. But it's the fundraising Wild West out there, isn't it?
Fundraising out of province, which is more controversial. But anyway, we got to move on.
I gave him $3,000, so that's...
I'm just going to say, everyone's love for Higgs may boomerang that way.
You piss your money away on scarves and jackets and asshole politicians. God, go. Man. Give Higgs, some to me.
Listeners who share a view of Higgs, you know what to do.
Our cursed clipping this week is from Mark McQueen, writing in the Toronto Star as an op-ed. He's writing about Poilievre, and he says, politics traditionally draws the type of person who cares deeply about what others think of them. That's only natural. To get elected, you need to be more popular than everyone else on the ballot. With almost 18 months under his belt as conservative leader, it's becoming clear that Poilievre has a certain superpower that sets him aside from most of his predecessors, whether they be liberal or conservative. He doesn't care what we think of him. That the guy is wired differently presents a unique challenge for the Liberals as they prepare for the 2025 campaign. How do you attack someone who doesn't care how the alleged elites view him? Poilievre's lack of interest in what we think of him is on full display in his daily media scrums. Having correctly determined that the press gallery will never be his allies, Canadians are getting accustomed to Poilievre's anti-charm offensive when responding to media questions. Canadians under the age of 30 never saw Ronald Reagan or Paul Martin in action. Having been raised on a diet of Joe Rogan or Donald Trump, young voters have a different benchmark about what a normal politician-journalist interaction looks like. Poilievre has clearly determined that it's more effective to punch than to take a hit, an approach that's not hurting his growing lead over Prime Minister Justin Trudeau with younger voters. For Poilievre, electoral success runs through the families of those who turn wrenches for a living, not the guys who wear French cuff dress shirts. That he doesn't care what we think is his superpower. Scott, take on this thesis. Is Poilievre's tone and approach a strength or a weakness?
This column is such a good example of a little point can be a dangerous thing. You know, of course. You know, of course he's running a modern day conservative, anti-elite campaign. And yeah, when he walks up to the microphone and warns people, warns corporate Canada, I'm not going to be listening to your corporate lobbyists. that gets noticed. But, you know, like this hackneyed cliched phrase, you know, these phrases go in and out of fashion. This is his superpower. Okay. All right. Fucking put your breathlessness back in the jar, set it on the fridge. Okay. Like just calm the fuck down. It's not a superpower. This isn't that insightful. It's not remarkable. This is what we knew. And I think really this is a letter to Bay Street from a Bay Street guy saying, hey, you know what? He's going to fuck you. So like, just get used to that. That's, you know, like that's his rhetoric. That's his play. That's how it's going to go. So I don't think there's anything new here. I don't think there's anything that astonishing. I think that, the service it provides is to Bay Street, who's probably sitting around with the Monte Cristos, as he talks about in the piece, thinking, well, I mean, he's just saying shit to get elected, but then he'll be taking our calls. And this guy's warning them, eh, maybe not so much. I just don't think, that anybody that's been paying the slightest bit of attention finds the slightest thing new here, and labeling it a superpower makes me giggle. It's kind of lame.
Corey, what do you think of the article? It's not traditionally how you advise your politicians that you're advising to comport themselves.
Well, you got to be yourself, and Poilievre is more like Harper than he is like a Ford or a Mulroney in terms of just the core personality that he has. And you know, you're always going to be a better you than you're going to be somebody else. And you know, he's not somebody who's a glad hander and you know, working the personal network, and you know, that kind of Mulroney element, that or the you know, the ability to do retail politics like Ford does. That's just not who he is. He's more of a speak to a rally, you know, have a really tight message of discipline. Like he's just a different kind of politician, and there's ways to make different styles work, but the right answer is always to be true to your own style, to be authentic insofar as you're able to do that. I think it's very smart to position the media as an enemy, because I think they are going to be an enemy for him, and to normalize that framing for voters generally. I do agree with the point in the piece that there are sharper elbows in political rhetoric now than have been in the past. And I think, especially for young voters, they're totally fine with that. You're not crossing any lines by doing it. And in fact, you're playing into what works in social media generally. So, you know, insofar as there's a difference, I think it's probably to his advantage.
We've been celebrating historical Canadian research milestones, from vaccines to AI, made possible by government funding. I am Shalini Iyer, a PhD candidate at UBC, where I research how the brain develops and the causes of autism. My dream is to one day run my own developmental neuroscience lab. Yet, this dream is shadowed by financial hurdles. I previously received a Canada Graduate Scholarship, but its value hadn't increased in 20 years. In fact, federal spending on science has dropped to the lowest level since the mid-90s. As a result, I've undertaken additional jobs, and the cost of living in Vancouver during my PhD only compounds the financial pressure. This is unacceptable. We must invest in more opportunities for underprivileged students, or risk losing them. U15 Canada and Supporter Science, as part of the Coalition for Canadian Research, are calling on the federal government to support science and talented Canadian researchers with a major investment this budget. Researchers need it. I need it. Canada needs it.
You know, Jordan, the last few years, I don't know, I guess I kind of attribute it to Trump's arrival, have just been like a burlesque show for norms. In electoral politics. And I don't, you know, so many things don't offend people that I thought would offend people, right? And I really wouldn't have honestly predicted that this approach by Poilievre would wear well. In fact, when I was looking at the prospect of a Poilievre leadership, one of the things I was counting on was that this wouldn't wear well. So why aren't people put off by it?
So I think there's a few things going on, and I think some of it has to do with how people and voters in general do and don't pay attention between elections. I think it has to do with the way his vote coalition has been assembled over time. And I think it also has to do with the diminishing role of the mainstream media in our political discourse. And so as to this piece, I think I, you know, maybe a bit like Scott, I wasn't like, I didn't, there was no, I thought brilliant insight in it. It's not a surprise. He's a populist. I think that the decision that he has taken really since prior to his leadership, but really intensified, obviously, since becoming leader, to go after the mainstream media as an enemy and to really antagonize them, it's pretty cost-free for him. And that's because the number of Canadians who are really drawing deep insights from mainstream media these days around their political choices has just shrunk. Like, it's just That's not where his potential universe is finding their information anymore. And he had a plan B. His ability to outreach on social media and to reach younger voters that way was just far more effective right from the outset. And so that, I think, is, to me, I didn't really think that that was necessarily going to be a risk for him, because there was a strong plan B in place that was clearly working for him, right? Where I do think that just, let's just call it being a dick in general, is a vulnerability is when you look at how his vote coalition has come together. So the people who were early supporters and the young men and the folks who are really, and you know, you talk about, like Corey talks about going to the rallies and the difference between him and some politicians that, you know, earlier generations got to see working a room and really had the royal jelly. Well, Polyev doesn't have the royal jelly, but he's got a lot, like, he's got the anger. He's got, like, that is really, that is the animating emotion behind his ability to rally people. And so the people who came to his vote coalition early on, I think were really, are drawn to that and are animated by it and are not turned off politics by it and are in fact drawn to becoming, like, that's, he's really finding new voters who may have stayed home in the past who are coming to him because of that emotion. But as you move along his voter coalition to some of the groups that have been more recently attracted to him, younger women, more middle-aged women, these are voters, I think, who are less animated by that particular dynamic and who perhaps were enticed in a little bit more by some of the work that his team did over the summer, you know, the softer ad campaign, the introduction to him as a you know, a warm and fuzzy person, all that stuff. And so to me, the vulnerability about his assholeness in general is really with that group of voters. And those are voters who are not really following necessarily the cut and thrust of day-to-day politics. They're not following his exchanges with the press gallery, but they will tune in during the election. And so I think that there is a chance there that when some of those exchanges, not necessarily with the media, but maybe with other leaders, with, you know, who knows, right? With protesters, sometimes it just takes an event, right? That could really be a vulnerability. And I think that also, I think his team knows that it's a vulnerability. Otherwise, they wouldn't have spent $3 million on that ad campaign. So I'm not persuaded that it's cost-free for him. I do think it's cost-free for him, by the way, to push off corporate Canada. I think it's very smart. And I think that actually that is something that is a bit of a shield for him as well against potentially some attacks from the populist left. Right. So I think that that's actually a pretty smart move on his part, because it takes the sting out of arguments that he is beholden to corporate Canada. So I think that that's a pretty smooth play there. But yeah, I absolutely do think that it's still a vulnerability. I just don't think it's an even vulnerability across his vote coalition.
Can I add two quick thoughts, David?
Yep.
I think, you know, to the core, I was, you know, a little dismissive of the piece and the author. I think, you know, just to be fair to them, the fundamental thesis is that Polyev has a strategy, and that's true, and we're seeing it. And I do think it's smart too, as Jordan says. I think that last point's very, very, very important. This is smart politics, way he's positioning himself, particularly vis-a-vis the corporate sector. And it's going to create a degree of latitude and freedom for him when he becomes prime minister, if he becomes prime minister like that. So there's, it'll help electorally, and it will help at least initially when and if he becomes prime minister. But two things I would say. One, the fundamental notion that he's unlike any other political leader and that he doesn't love the love, that's wrong. He loves the love. It just shows up in different places, right? They all love the fucking love. These people are addicted to it, right? And some of them show it, like, you know, Brian Mulroney and Bill Clinton and so forth. Like, they hug people, they withdraw energy from phone calls and conversations and all of that, right? And some of them show up when they stand in front of
Alex Jones love, like,
right? But some of them do it when it's like, oh, get a load to me and my 3,000 person rally, and, you know, give them wings and they shall fly, like that. You know, there's so, like, let's not fool ourselves. We haven't seen the dawn of a new breed of politician who isn't plugged in to self-gratification and narcissism. That persists. The second thing is, and this is a thesis I have. I do think he sounds like a dick, and I don't think people care. I don't think they care because he's pointing his dick, if you'll pardon the phrase, at Trudeau, and they're okay with that. Sometimes he points his dick at the media, and they're okay with that. But if and when he becomes prime minister, this thing could turn on him fucking hard and fucking fast, because then he's going to be pointing his dick at them. He's going to be, every time a Canadian or a concern arises and he snarls and says someone who questions him is a racist or an asshole, or they're a no good, fellow traveler with his opponents. It's going to sound more in office like Nixon than it does like a winning populist play during a campaign. So I don't think it's going to hurt him necessarily during a campaign. I think it could really harm him in office. And I think he could have one of the most short-lived, suddenly ended honeymoons of any recent elected leader we've seen. But he's got to get there first.
Yeah, so we'll come back to that in 2027.
Sounds good.
but I think there is a general point made in that piece, and we've touched on it a little bit. But the changing media platforms, they do reward the sharper elbow stuff. Like, what are the big lessons that we've learned from Trump or social media generally? The throwing punches and being sharper in the rhetoric has been a plus, not a minus, across the board in ways that have surprised those of us in the pundit class again and again. And I feel like this is going to be a long term feature of how to be successful in the current media environment. And it's changed. It just has.
Jean Charest and Bill Morneau notwithstanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to have an employer pension plan, you might not realize that nearly two-thirds of Canadian workers don't. And that's a problem. You probably know that when it comes to investing, the earlier you start and the more you stick with it, the more likely you are to reach your financial goals. And you might also know that a group retirement savings plan, or GRSP, makes it a lot easier to get started by opting into automatic payroll deductions or matching employer contributions. Unfortunately, Canadians working for the small and medium-sized businesses that keep our country going are among the least likely to have access to a pension or a GRSP. That's where Wealthsimple comes in. They help almost 1,000 small and medium-sized businesses offer retirement savings plans, something the vast majority of them had never done before. The payoff? Over 45,000 Canadian workers have a jump start on saving for their future. Panelists and all of you accursed out there, I have for the second straight week fucked up the management of this discussion. And we really don't have time to talk about the latest things on the Trudeau offensive, interesting as it is. So we'll have to devote more time to that next week, but my apologies for this week. We're going to have to go right to our Hey You's.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey You's are about to begin.
So, Scott, do you got a Hey You for us?
Sure. My Hey You's a little different this week. We're recording this at about 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Is it daylight time now? Eastern Daylight Time?
No, we have the daylight. You don't need to save it anymore. You're good.
All right. And it's about 10 o'clock in the morning. A few hours from now, maybe not here in Toronto where it's cloudy, we may not see, but the God will blink his eye and the sun will be blotted from the sky. And I just think, when we reflect on the state of politics, the Bill Morneau and Jean Charest letter, the state of things in the United States, the Donald Trump and Marjorie Greene Taylor and so forth, I'm just... You know what? Turn us all to salt. Let it rip. Bring on the eclipse ellipse. I'm all for it.
The rapture. Here we go.
I don't think Scott's getting raptured.
Wallow in your filth. Let's just end it. Let's go Old Testament, man. So I'm hoping that it's...
What are we waiting for? How bad is it supposed to get?
I'm ready to go.
I didn't have Scott down as a trut, but here we are.
Excellent. What do you got for us this week, Jordan?
Oh my God, I'm going to wring my hands about that fucking tweet from Polyev at Charlie Angus. I really am. Because I think two things, and this is just to go back to our earlier conversation. I think that when you're the leader of a political party and somebody who served two decades in parliament, and by all accounts, friend or foe, has served well, like, you just say thank you for your service. You don't have to take a punch. You know, like, it's cheap and it makes you look thin-skinned. It makes you look insecure. And so I know that Corey's going to say that no one sees it and that it's just fundraising, it's for his base. I know all those things. But I think that it's an example of exactly what we were talking about. You have to be careful with that instinct to be an asshole. So yes, Charlie may be a political opponent, and Charlie may be somebody that the blue team thinks they're gonna take his riding. We'll see. But Charlie was also overwhelmingly elected by the people of Northern Ontario for 20 fucking years. And a lot of those voters that Polyev is trying to appeal to like and voted for Charlie. So I think that the team around Polyev, who is encouraging the asshole-ishness and who thought this tweet was real funny and really good politics, I think you guys have to be careful about encouraging that. Polyev is an asshole, like, at his core. That is, like, who he is. It's going to come out. You don't need to encourage it. And when you have just spent boatloads of money trying to shave the rough edges off somebody who thinks that this kind of stuff is absolutely motherhood and apple pie and lots of fun, you don't need to egg it on. That is bad advice. And that's my hey you.
There you go. All right, Corey, what do you got?
Well, I'm adding a new entry into the Vashi Capellas files.
Oh, no.
we had another Liberal cabinet minister who can't pronounce the name of the number one political host in Canada today, who's filling more airtime talking Ottawa politics than anyone else. The winner this past week is Jenna Suds, the Minister for Families, Children and Social Development, and MP for Kanata Carleton. She managed to not only come across like she'd just taken a handful of goofballs before doing the interview, but also managed to call Vaggie like about 40 times. So I don't know whether there's like some sort of female genitalia obsession or something, or what's going on.
It's a term of affection.
Her name is Vashi, not Vaggie. Anyway, I think they need to do a workshop at the next caucus meeting where they just, you know, show a picture of Vashi and everyone practices in small groups.
I'm awfully glad you said Vashi. I was afraid.
And then
there's only one other alternative to get through that error. Yeah.
Anyway, it's quite something.
All right. My hey you, I got a two-parter this week. One is non-political, the second one is political. The non-political one is, look at the jersey I am wearing right now. It's a half Saskatchewan Rough Rider jersey, half Montreal Canadiens jersey. It's the most beautiful piece of clothing I own. It was given to me on my 50th birthday by Ken Dryden and Jim Hobson. Jim Hobson was a former offensive lineman for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, was the head of the Buffalo Plains School Division out in Lumsden, was the president and CEO of the Saskatchewan Rough Riders for a decade, and he was my friend, and he died last week. And thank you, Jim, for everything. I'm going to miss you terribly. My political note is to Stephen Harper, Jean Chrétien, Sheila Copps, Lawrence Martin, and whoever the fuck else thinks that Justin Trudeau should agree to a plan for money to be raised by the private sector to rebuild 24 Sussex. Chrétien and Harper have volunteered to raise private sector money to rebuild 24 Sussex. And now, you know, people are crapping on Trudeau for not agreeing to this plan. You know, he's not stupid at all, and he's certainly not that fucking stupid. That somebody at 23% in the polls in the middle of a housing and affordability crisis would allow $30 million of anybody's money to be spent on their own on their own accommodation. This is something that both Harper and Chrétien would have had the smarts to wave off in a similar position when they were in charge. And it's a ridiculous proposition right now. And let's just put it aside. It's the NAC's job. Do your job.
All right. I love both yeah, those. I just want to throw in a word saying, I just an echo. I love Jim. He was a lovely guy.
Yeah. Thanks. All right, you accursed. That's our show for this week. I want to thank Corey, Jordan, and Scott for being here with me. I want to thank all of you who watched or listened. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, our sponsor, CN, Bruce Power, U15 Canada, and Wealth Simple. And we'll be back next week with more Curse of Politics and maybe some Trudeau. See you then.